Illinois law requires that all sex ed course material must, quote, teach honor and respect for monogamous heterosexual marriage. What might that mean for LGBT youth? Here's advocate Elizabeth Nash.
You are sending a big red signal, a big flashing sign, that discussion around LGBTQIA issues are not on the agenda.
Plus, a former member of the European Parliament joins us. Robert Evans was at the U of I to talk about Europe, the UK, and of course, Brexit.
There will be the bizarre, almost unprecedented situation where the government have proposals and nothing can get through. And then we could well be in almost a constitutional crisis that we don't know what would happen.
But first, in 2 months, J.B. Pritzker becomes our next governor. He takes office with a Democratic supermajority in the State House. We take a look at what's next in Springfield. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll take a look at Illinois laws around sex education and why the law contains language that some LGBT advocates find troubling. I also sit down with Robert Evans, a former member of the European Parliament. But first, for the next 2 months or so, J.B. Pritzker will be getting ready to step in as the next governor of Illinois. His win last week means that Democrats have an even stronger hold on state government than they did before. The Democratic Party will now hold every statewide office and have a supermajority in the General Assembly. So what should we expect from the Pritzker administration in 2019 and beyond? Mick Dumke is a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. He's on the line with us now to talk about this. Hey, Mick, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
So let's start with Election Day results. Last week, we saw Democrats making big gains in the Midwest, especially in Illinois, as I mentioned, now having a supermajority in Springfield, holding all statewide offices. How different is this going to be than the past 4 years?
Well, if the election results are any indication, it should be drastically different. We obviously are not going to have a governor anymore who's had a long list of agenda items that he wanted to click off. That's what Bruce Rauner came in vowing to do. But they basically, one by one, they all seem to fall away except for his mission of attacking Mike Madigan and trying to serve as a counterpoint to Speaker Mike Madigan. So we won't have Bruce Rauner. I keep saying we don't have Bruce Rauner to kick around anymore, of course, the way Richard Nixon once lamented his fate, saying you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. But Bruce Rauner, listen, was blamed for the two-year budget impasse. It takes more than two to tango in this case, but voters largely saw Bruce Rauner as the single source of that failure to pass a budget because, you know, that is the main thing that the governor is supposed to do every year is get a budget through the General Assembly or propose a budget that the General Assembly can pass. That didn't happen, so voters lashed out at him. But Nyla, I think one of the big concerns from a lot of people, including people who voted Democrat, is what happens with one-party rule. You don't have a GOP statewide officer in sight anymore. Both branches of the General Assembly now have huge Democratic majorities, so it just doesn't really seem like there's anything to stop the Democrats right now.
And to that point, you mentioned how Speaker Michael Madigan, widely considered to be one, if not the most powerful person in state politics, are there meaningful political differences between Governor-elect Pritzker and Speaker Madigan as far as you could tell?
That is a question that we all want answered, and I don't think it's going to be answered immediately. That we could tell, no. But I should say, over the years, Speaker Madigan, of course, first won his seat in the General Assembly in 1971. And over the years, he has proven to be rather pliable on specific policies and specific issues. The main current, the main constant, I should say, of his tenure is mastering the art of holding on to power. That's not to say that the speaker doesn't believe anything, just that he is, first and foremost, is a political master operator and someone who controls the lever of power. So when it comes to specific legislation, specific policies, the speaker isn't really known for that as much as he is at controlling how legislation gets through Springfield or doesn't. By the same token, I think the governor-elect, J.B. Pritzker, has put some stuff out there. He certainly laid out a progressive-leaning agenda on the campaign trail, talking about health care, talking about legalizing marijuana for recreational use, talking about a progressive income tax. But the specifics were largely missing from most of those plans. How are you going to do these things? Where are you going to get the money to implement some of your plans? How exactly would legalization happen? The progressive income tax would require, of course, a change in the state constitution. And J.B. Pritzker's already stopped talking about that, even in the week since he was elected. So I think it remains to be seen how these individuals are going to work together and what specific policies kind of rise to the top.
And to your point, Mick, I know it's a big question. I posed it to Governor-elect Pritzker last week after he won, asking him how he planned to operate independently from the speaker. Here's what he said to me about it.
Well, let's start with the facts here, which are no matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that you've got to work with whoever the Speaker of the House is or the President of the Senate, because you don't get to choose who they are. It's just they've been chosen already. And so you've got to be able to work with them. And I'm not somebody who walks out of the room when you can't agree on something. I have worked together with people to get real things done, like expanding preschool and child care, like building an incubator that's created thousands and thousands of jobs. And so I'm going to work with the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, and the chairs of the various committees so that we can get real things done for working families.
And I should say, he added that he put a call on Tuesday night after he won to GOP leadership in the Senate and House to reach out to them as well. I wonder what you might make of that answer from Governor-elect Pritzker. Does it give us a sense of the kind of relationship he might have with Speaker Madigan? Again, he's being pretty careful about how he answers that.
The answer to that question is no. I don't think it gives us any insight into what his relationship will be. A couple points, though. First of all, Bruce Rauner claimed that he reached out to the Democratic leadership immediately after he won the election 4 years ago. I mean, so this isn't something that's new to try to reach across the aisle and say, hey, I want to work with you. It's actually the least that a governor-elect can do to...
It's the minimum they should be doing, right?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. It's exactly what they should be doing. They should be in communication with all of the legislative leaders because, as he noted, that's who you're going to have to work with. And the second point, Nyla, is that without speaking the current governor's name, J.B. Pritzker is trying to distinguish himself and his style immediately from Bruce Rauner's. Bruce Rauner, as I was mentioning earlier, widely criticized for not being able to preside over a smooth budget process, widely criticized for not working with the Speaker of the House. Of course, he's a Republican. He was elected in part 4 years ago because he said he was going to be a counterpoint to Mike Madigan and the Democrats. People expected that of him, but they also expected him to get something done, to sit down at the table, to be tough, to hammer out a compromise and get something done for the citizens of Illinois. And to hear J.B. Pritzker saying that's what he's going to do, he's trying to basically tell all of us that he is going to serve in a way that is a great contrast to Bruce Rauner.
I'm speaking with Mick Dumke from ProPublica, Illinois. We're talking about a new Pritzker administration and what this would look like. I want to just play another clip to your point, Mick. It's from an interview that I did with Governor-elect Pritzker. It was actually a couple weeks before Election Day. And it's kind of to your point about thinking about current Governor Bruce Rauner and the budget crisis.
For 2 years, we went without a budget because Bruce Rauner failed. And then a third year that he vetoed the budget and Republicans came together with Democrats in the legislature to override his veto. He doesn't really understand how to balance a budget.
That's J.B. Pritzker, now governor-elect J.B. Pritzker. Mick, as you know, that's we heard that so many times on the campaign trail, right?
Yeah.
But I just a quick postmortem question for Governor Rauner. Do you think the budget crisis, I wonder what your sense is of that's what led to Governor Rauner's unpopularity? How much of it? There's so many more other things that were involved when we think about the national picture and President Trump as well. I wonder how much you think the budget crisis played an impact in Governor Rauner only serving one term.
Well, my sense is you're right that there were a whole host of issues. The budget crisis, though, was symbolic of what a lot of people saw as Bruce Rauner's inability to achieve anything of significance. And I know that sounds a little bit harsh, but in 4 years, what can you point to that Bruce Rauner did? his supporters would probably say that the biggest thing he did was back a case against public sector unions that got all the way to the Supreme Court and a conservative Supreme Court.
Janus versus AFSCME.
In favor of Bruce Rauner's side in that, which, limits in some ways the strength of or could limit the strength of public sector unions. But that's not really something he did as governor of Illinois. I mean, it doesn't have that much to do with the actual governing process here. He could have very well done the same thing as a private citizen favoring those policies. And in fact, his on-again, off-again allies at the Illinois Policy Institute, conservative think tank, were really the ones who carried through that case all the way to the Supreme Court. So my point is that if you're a conservative who wants to see these kind of conservative reforms, that's probably the main thing Bruce Rauner did during the time he was in office. But as the governor of Illinois, I think he is best known for the budget impasse, like you said, ultimately having his veto overridden. That said, in fairness to Governor Rauner, he happens to be in the same party as Donald Trump. And let's be honest, he really didn't do a very good job of distinguishing himself from Trump. A lot of people went out and just voted against anybody they could that they could say was associated in any way, whether it was just simply by being in the same party as Trump. Bruce Rauner, of course, a Republican, and tried to distance himself from Trump, except when he didn't, right? So we saw late hour.
Right, showing up in Southern Illinois when the president was here.
Showing up and
but not speaking to the president, just being there.
Not speaking to the president, getting snubbed by the president. So after, for 2 years, trying to basically give off the impression that you are standing apart from Donald Trump, then when it looks like your campaign's in trouble, you decide to go to a Trump rally, and you don't even get the time of day from him. So you ended up kind of looking like a loser on all fronts in the way you played that.
Mick, what do you think this means then for the future of the Illinois GOP? I mean, when you think about the fact that Governor Rauner had an opponent on the right challenging him, Sam McCann, he had a really tough primary with another state lawmaker, Jeannie Ives. Where do you think the future of the Illinois Republican Party goes from here?
Well, I think the big question is, do the people who are sort of the traditional Republicans, the traditional either Reagan Republicans or centrist Republicans, do they have enough bodies and do they have enough money and do they have a way to maintain control of the party? Bruce Rauner, in addition to being the sitting governor, was the primary funder of the Illinois GOP over the last 4, 5, 6 years. Since the time he decided to run for governor himself, he started spreading some of his wealth around to Republican organizations around the state, down to like the county and township level. So if he not only leaves office, but walks away from his role as a leader in the Republican Party, as a funder of the Republican Party, well, who's going to fill that spot? Right now, as you noted, Nyla, the conservatives are kind of licking their chops. I mean, nobody thought Jeannie Ives was going to have a chance against Bruce Rauner in the primary. And then she came within a couple percentage points of knocking him off. And Jeannie Ives, very conservative. She is aligned with activist Dan Proft, who, of course, runs a conservative super PAC. And they're funded by Richard Uihlein, who is a Lake Forest-based businessman who is one of the most prolific Republican donors, conservative donors around the country. He supported Roy Moore, for instance, was one of his big funders in the Alabama Senate race earlier this year. So my point with all these names, all this information, is that the right wing of the Republican Party is well-funded, and they are very clear about what their mission is, to keep pushing the party, keep pushing the state to the right. Is there a counterbalancing force of moderates or traditional Reagan Republicans who can fight them off and can maintain control of the party? It's going to be very interesting to watch over the next couple of years.
And to that point about money, let me just ask you one last question as we wrap up here about the fact that now J.B. Pritzker beat him in part because this was one of the most, I don't know how much of this is because of this, but certainly it was the most expensive governor's race in American history, $243 million. J.B. Pritzker, billionaire, heir to the Hyatt fortune. How much is of a difference going to be that there's a Democratic governor who has his own war chest?
Well, you know, a lot of people are speculating that because he's wealthy, he won't be pushed around by other traditional political forces, namely, again, the aforementioned ever-present Speaker of the House, Michael Madigan. But, I don't know if that's true. People were saying the same thing about Bruce Rauner 4 years ago. He's independently wealthy. He doesn't owe his office to anybody. He has his own, basically his own store-bought base because of all those resources at his disposal. And we saw that Bruce Rauner got repeatedly outmaneuvered, outmuscled by Michael Madigan. So what will happen with J.B. Pritzker? Certainly, we know this about Pritzker. He has watched what has happened over the last 4 years. As we already discussed, he is trying to signal he's going to be a very different kind of governor. And I have to believe that he and his team are intent on not making the same mistakes Bruce Rauner did, at the very least. I also think, as a fellow Democrat, he's going to try to find ways to work with Mike Madigan. They're not starting off on a footing where they're fighting each other. They're starting off as fellow members of the party, and the Democrats are all singing unity right now. So I think that the chances are much better that things are going to get done. How independent is Pritzker going to be? What would be the issues that they end up potentially clashing on, having to iron out a compromise, that's all going to be very interesting to see.
Right, and there are issues where Governor Rauner wanted to act on gun control, for example, bump stocks I'm thinking of in particular, and the legislature did not want to cooperate. So it will be interesting to see what happens now. Mick Dumke is a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. Thanks for being with me, Mick. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. Really appreciate it, Nyla. Good talking with you.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual book, jacket, and journal show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, November 5th through the 16th. University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Think back to middle school or high school for a moment. Can you remember sitting in health class for sex education? Maybe through the awkward laughter, your teacher was able to cover the basics. But what are the basics? Maybe your class only touched on heterosexual relationships, or maybe you didn't have any sex ed at all. Currently, Illinois law doesn't require sex education across all school districts. It also doesn't mandate that curriculum include discussion of LGBT identities and experiences. But it does say that all course material must, quote, teach honor and respect for monogamous heterosexual marriage. We've gathered a few folks to talk about this, but let's start with Lily Ferguson. Lily's a 17-year-old senior at Jones College Prep in Chicago. Hi, Lily. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Hi, thank you.
So as I just mentioned, you're a senior in high school. What has your sex education experience been like so far?
So in middle school, I had a pretty good experience. The teachers were very knowledgeable and were offering to teach as much as students asked. They had ask boxes and were very inclusive of everything. My eighth grade teacher even included like LGBT words in the vocabulary, but never really had a lesson on it. Whereas in high school, I only received 1 year of sex education, and it was very fear-mongering, and I didn't really appreciate it. It was a big shift for me coming from having a very good experience with sex education in middle school. They showed us pictures of what STDs looks like, trying to scare us out of having sex. They showed us a video of a 14-year-old giving birth, trying to scare us out of having sex.
Oh,
it was very fear-mongering. And in Chicago, the policy is that we're supposed to have sex ed every single year, but my school and many other schools that I know didn't have that. One of my friends actually fought for sex ed to be extended to sophomores as well, but that came after I was a sophomore.
That's Lily Ferguson. She's a senior at Jones College Prep in Chicago. She's also a member of the Youth Committee of the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance. It's a statewide group that promotes healthy development, safety, and support for LGBTQ youth. I want to bring Lee Gaines into this conversation. She's a reporter with the Illinois Newsroom. She's with me in our Urbana studios, and why we're having this conversation, because she has been doing the reporting. Hi, Lee. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Dan Rice is also with us. He's on the line from Rutgers University, where he's the director of training for ANSWER. They're a national organization that promotes and trains teachers to provide comprehensive sex education. Dan, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So, Lee, we were just hearing Lily talk about what's required in Chicago. What is required across the state of Illinois? Are there specific regulations around this?
There are. So I think the first thing that's important to know is that the Illinois law does not mandate sex ed across all school districts. So it's optional. The second thing is that if you do teach sex ed in Illinois, it's kind of like an if-then law, meaning if you do teach it, you have to hit certain criteria. It has to be medically accurate. It has to be, quote unquote, comprehensive. But how that curriculum plays out on a district-to-district level or on a classroom-to-classroom level varies pretty widely, because most of this curriculum is adopted at the local level, and there's no check-ins by the Illinois State Board of Education. They're not policing this. There's actually no testing that goes on with sex education. So there's no standards. There's no metric to see how districts are teaching this.
And Dan, this may seem like an obvious question, but why is it important to have good sex education for our young people, especially when we're thinking about at the high school level?
Well, when we're thinking about sex ed at the high school level, we're giving them information about healthy relationships. We're giving them information about how their body works. And we're kind of setting them up for a healthy and successful future in many different ways. And without that education, we find more and more young people who don't understand how their bodies work and don't recognize the signs of maybe an unhealthy relationship or a dangerous relationship. And so just being really inclusive and covering all the different aspects of a comprehensive sexual health education curriculum is really important.
And Lee, I mentioned this requirement at the beginning about it seems like such, honestly, it seems kind of like weird language. I'm just going to be really honest with you about saying that this, it has to, so basically, is this from 1989 that you have this, any education has to promote heterosexual monogamous marriage?
Yes, that's correct. So this dates back to when the state first implemented any regulations or rules around sex ed. So that was in 1989. And part of those requirements was that any sex ed curriculum must, quote, teach honor and respect for monogamous heterosexual marriage. So when I was looking into the sex ed law, that just set me off on this story. I was like, why is this here? It seems kind of a strange line to have in the law, especially in 2018 in Illinois. And so even though that law has gone through several iterations, the last big one being in 2013 when they passed comprehensive sex education in Illinois, and that was an effort to move away from abstinence-only education in Illinois, they left that line in the law.
Dan, is this typical, this language, this kind of instruction? Do you think Illinois is different than other states in this regard, or is it pretty normal?
I don't know that that particular language is particularly normal, but the experience in Illinois is pretty normal. There's no federal mandate around what needs to be included in this sexual health education program. The policy is decided on a state-by-state basis, and actually only 24 states in the District of Columbia require sex ed to be taught at all.
We're talking about this whole idea of sex education with a couple of folks. Lily Ferguson is with us. She's a senior, a high school senior in Chicago. Dan Rice is also with us on the line from Rutgers University. He's the director of training for ANSWER. Lee Gaines is with us in studio here in Urbana. Lily, as you're listening to all of this, I wonder what you think. You're on, I mentioned this earlier, you're a member of the youth committee that helps advise schools on this issue. When you're hearing what Dan's describing of what the curriculum should include, what would you like to see?
I believe that what Lee said is included. The line about heterosexual monogamous marriage should probably be removed, especially since this is coming from a 2013 iteration of the law. It seems unnecessary to me and exclusionary of LGBTQ students in particular.
So that's where you would start. It sounds like, Lily, you'd start there. And when we're thinking about this, Dan, less than 7% of LGBT youth, there's one survey that we found in 2017, reported that they received LGBT inclusive and affirming sex education. I wonder how you think only discussing heterosexual relationships, health, and marriage might be harmful to LGBT youth. Dan?
I think that by not including LGBTQ youth in sex education, we're basically erasing them from the curriculum entirely. Doing that can further increase feelings of isolation, depression. It really devalues their experience and their relationships. That could put them at risk for bullying, lower self-esteem issues. And we know that young LGBTQ youth are definitely at an increased risk for things like depression, suicide, academic failure, drug, alcohol, and tobacco use. We also know that sexual minority students who are sexually active are about 2 times more likely to report becoming pregnant or getting someone pregnant. And so these are real issues that have a real impact on greater society, not just on the sex ed curriculum.
Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking about this, Dan, I know that this original language we were talking about in the law dates back to 1989. I imagine you would say the discussion, I mean, that's 30 years ago. So how much do you think the discussion about how and what we teach and how we teach sex education, how that's changed in that time?
There have certainly been efforts to change how we teach sex education. There are a set of national sexuality education standards that have been presented as a model that were published in 2012. So it's providing guidance. There are lots of organizations like ANSWER out there that are providing professional development for educators. Unfortunately, it's just not valued in the sense that there's not a lot of money for professional development educators. There's not really a certification process for sexuality educators. And so what we find is that in a lot of classrooms, we have educators who are just not prepared or comfortable even to teach sex education in general, much less LGBT inclusive sex education.
Lee, who is teaching this? I mean, health is required across Illinois schools. And does this fall under that? And who teaches health classes normally? Are those?
So I think a lot of people have this experience where their physical education teacher ends up teaching health class. I know that that was my experience. From the few districts that I've talked to about this, that typically tends to be the experience. Unfortunately, the Illinois State Board of Education is not keeping track of how many districts across the state are teaching sex ed. All districts are supposed to be teaching health, but you can teach a health class and not touch on sex ed. I mean, that's entirely possible. They are required to talk somewhat about AIDS. But, I mean, that's just one small component of sexual education.
Dan, what kind of concerns do you hear from educators you're working with? I imagine one of them is just the ability. This is a topic where I'm sure teachers always want to be well prepared, but I would think especially in an area like this.
Yeah, definitely. One of the concerns we often hear is that there's not a lot of training provided for them. They may not have had training in their teacher preparation courses, and so they're just kind of going into the school and being asked to teach health, and they have maybe a health credential but don't necessarily have any formal training in sex education. The other thing that we're hearing is that a lot of them just know that this is important, but because there's no policy in place in their schools around what they can and can't discuss, they just don't feel like they have that safety net there in order to be able to answer the questions that young people have or to talk about an LGBT inclusive perspective without there being some kind of pushback from parents or administrators.
And Lee, you mentioned that there has been some updates to this law in 2013. Does Illinois provide any framework to help teachers out in this respect?
There's some framework in the law, and there are also organizations like the Illinois Caucus for Adolescent Health does a lot of work around reproductive. So they go into districts that invite them in and they do some training around this. They're mostly based in the Chicago area. They actually helped CPS develop its sex ed policies. But in terms of the rest of the state of Illinois, that's less clear to me what's going on. So essentially what the Illinois State Board of Education says is it's really up to the districts at the local level to choose what curricula they want to implement. And there's no, you know, checks on what they're doing, essentially. And I will also say that in terms of changing this policy from a statewide perspective, I've been told by multiple sources in Springfield, that that would actually be a pretty difficult thing to do.
To change the policy, meaning change the language?
Change the language and also mandate inclusion of LGBTQ identities in sex ed to make that explicitly part of a comprehensive sex education in Illinois. Right now, what they're trying to do, and they have been trying to do this, is to push for LGBTQ inclusive history curriculum. And that's been an uphill battle. And what I've heard is that it would be even more difficult for them to pass legislation specifically around sex ed.
Lily, as the high school student involved in this conversation, what do you think schools should be doing around this issue? Because obviously you guys are talking about this stuff, even if your teachers aren't talking to you about it.
Yeah. So in terms of my work with the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, a lot of other students who are on the youth council with me say that they haven't had any knowledge about LGBTQ, anything history, sex ed coming from their schools. People who I've spoken with at workshops who aren't on our youth committee also have said similar things to this. Students at my school in my LGBTQ Pride Club have the same ideas. My school actually currently, or my Pride Club, is working on sending out some information to our teachers about how they can include LGBT people in history classes and in general. And I think that often it can fall onto the students to have to speak up for this. And I would think that most students would be really appreciative if that wasn't what happened anymore, because it can be really difficult to speak up for this, especially when we are as young as we are and many students aren't even let out as LGBTQ yet. So I think that schools and teachers and administration taking these steps to look into LGBTQ history, look into LGBTQ sex ed, ask students who they know who are LGBTQ what they want from the school, rather than forcing students to come to them and forcing students to start conversations. As students, we can start these conversations if we want, but it would be much nicer and much more comfortable if we didn't have to.
Lily, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to end by asking you on that point what you want parents or other adults who are listening to this to know. It sounds like you're saying we would like the adults to come to us and talk to us about this. How would you suggest they do that?
If people know LGBTQ students, it can be helpful to say, hey, we're trying to start this conversation in the school, and we thought that you might have some sort of point of view about it or some thoughts on it. I know many students who would be comfortable talking about that. I know many students who wouldn't be comfortable talking about that. So just starting that conversation with students, seeing if they are comfortable about speaking about it, and saying, what are your thoughts on inclusion in history? How do you think we can do better? Do you know any resources for this that could help us? Having students start the conversation can be helpful, but schools and policymakers and administrators should be willing to do more of the work, because it shouldn't all fall back onto LGBTQ people.
That's Lily Ferguson. She's a 17-year-old senior at Jones College Prep in Chicago. I want to thank Dan Rice, who's the director of training with ANSWER, a national organization based at Rutgers, and Lee Gaines for bringing this story to us with the Illinois Newsroom. We will tweet out Lee's story if you'd like to read more about this, but I want to thank Lee, Dan, and Lily for being with me. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you think our midterm elections were big news in the U.S., what about in Europe? Much of the world was also engrossed in last week's election. Of course, Europe and the U.K. have also had their own political news we've been following as details of Brexit continue to be hammered out. Last week, I had a chance to host a forum on transatlantic relations for the University of Illinois' EU Center on the Urbana campus. One of the participants was my next guest, former member of European Parliament Robert Evans. He was a member for 15 years. He also served as chairman of the European Parliamentary Labour Party. He's now a lecturer at Royal Holloway College of London University and a councillor representing Surrey. Mr. Evans, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So how much do you think the UK was paying? You were actually in the States for the results, but how big was the midterm elections? How big of a story do you think this was in the UK?
It was a big story, much bigger than previous midterm elections have been, as far as I can recall. It was on the news every night. It was in the papers, and there was coverage and journalists following it and trying to imagine what was going to happen and make predictions. So obviously it wasn't as big as it would have been here in America, but it was much bigger than I recall with previous midterm elections.
And do you think the same would be true for Europe as well, in terms of the rest of Europe paying attention to what's happening here?
I think the other countries would have been as interested, perhaps not quite as much, because Britain and obviously the sort of close relationship with the United States and the same language, but certainly the other countries would have been interested in what was going on.
I was actually in Scotland this summer, actually the same time as our president. So I was there when all of the protest happened. And I was surprised at how even on the smallest islands I was on, people were so engaged in everything that was happening in the U.S. People were even asking me about James Comey, for example. Do you think there's a sense from the U.K. that things have changed in America?
Oh, very definitely. Yes, I think people are really worried. And I don't want to be too unkind to your president, but it would be true to say he's not very popular in the United Kingdom. And people are concerned about some of the policies that he's pushing through, some of the attitudes that he's displaying, not just now, but during the election. And the coverage of the Supreme Court judge, the whole nomination process and the controversy around that. That was big news on British television because it's very different from the way that we process for becoming Supreme Court judges in the United Kingdom. So people were concerned, and we respect the right of America, obviously, to do what it likes. But this is where I think it would be true to say that President Trump isn't the most popular person in the United Kingdom at the moment.
When we're thinking about what's happening in the U.S., when we've seen such a troubling rise in violence, and I'm thinking particularly about anti-Semitism, white supremacy, this is obviously not new to Europe. And I wonder what similarities or differences there are right now between what we're seeing with the rise of far-right nationalist parties, both between Europe as well as the U.S.
Yeah, I think that there is definitely a different mood in politics at the moment. And the fact that the mainstream political parties in most European countries are struggling. And President Trump represented, although he was a mainstream party, he represented a strand of political thinking and views which is different from the norm for elections. And it's probably a mark of the failure of traditional political parties that the far right, even far left, and perhaps nationalist parties, so-called popular movements within European countries have come to the fore. And so the traditional parties, and I represent the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, but the same would be true of the Conservative Party, the party of government, have got to take account of what's going on. You can't just dismiss it because people vote for it. People vote for the Republicans and President Trump's agenda in America. And we've got to respect the fact that there's something going on there that we need to respond to.
I'm curious about that, because I think when you look at the Labour Party in the UK, you look at the Democratic Party here, both of those used to be seen as the parties of the working class. And I wonder how much you think that's still true.
Well, it's very interesting. And if I dwell on the Labour Party, for example, the last two or three years, we've had a leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who's not from the mainstream of the Labour Party. He's more to the left of the Labour Party. But that doesn't mean to say that we are necessarily getting the traditional working class Labour support that we used to get. And in fact, at the last general election, 2017, Labour won university town like Canterbury that we'd never won before, and then lost the seats in former mining communities like Mansfield in the Midlands, which we'd never lost before. So there's a polarisation that is very different from what we were to be expecting. So, yes, Labour is still the party that many people will be automatically attracted to, but it's a different mix probably now, a different coalition of views. And we know that the challenge is that we don't speak for the same cross-section of society as perhaps we used to.
And I wonder how that you think that plays out here in America. And I'm just thinking about our recent election and result and our new governor, our governor-elect, who will be the richest politician in America, richer than even President Trump.
Yes.
Certainly, we had the most expensive election in Illinois in American history for a governor's race, more than $234 million spent. The amount of money, I wonder, from your perspective, does it seem kind of nuts, the amount of money?
It's just beyond comprehension, because we have very strict restrictions on how much can be spent in elections, and woe betide any party that spends more than that or any candidate. So you could be the richest candidate in the world in British politics and you couldn't spend more, because there are strict limits on how much can be spent by individual candidates and by political parties. So yes, parties do spend a lot of money, but it's nothing compared to the amount of money that's been spent here in Illinois. So it's a different setup. It always has been. American politics is different in that sense than British politics. But the political parties in America, I think the structure and the traditional bases are breaking down. And we've watched interviews with people going out to vote in America and there was one where a journalist was speaking to a woman who'd previously been a Democrat and said she was now voting for Republicans. And the journalist went through a list of the policies. She was a lesbian woman. She was saying, "And how on earth can you be voting Republican when Mr. Trump is saying this?" And then they put a whole string of different policies that Republicans were supporting that she couldn't have agreed with, but she was still going to vote for them. So yeah, there's definitely something going on there that's rather different now.
And I wonder also what you think about when we think about the level of money in American politics, but then also getting back to what we were talking about earlier about our two-party system here. Do you think anyone is really representing working people in America? Is there a party that's really representing that?
Well, no, you have a very polarized two-party system, except in some little extremes in some states. And that's because that's where the money is. And I suppose that makes the parties, as they are in Britain, but the parties themselves are a broad church, a coalition of views. And certainly the Labour Party would assimilate more with the Democrats. But then there are plenty of Conservatives in Britain who'd support the Democrats in America, because the way that things fit into the same sort of spectrum. I don't think traditionally Labour or more socialist parties in America have found it easy to make a breakthrough. In fact, they found it very, very difficult. And trade unions in some areas don't really know who to support. And certainly you're saying your new governor is a very rich man, which probably wouldn't be happening in British politics.
Very pro-union, but yes, very wealthy. Yeah. Healthcare was one of the biggest issues in this American election. And I wonder how you view that, given the nature of how healthcare has been designed in the UK for so long.
Well, we're very proud of our National Health Service, and no politician or political party in Britain is going to really tamper with the fact that anybody can turn up at hospital or a doctor's surgery and be treated, and you don't pay a penny at all. And indeed, many tourists would still be treated as well without paying anything. Whereas the system in America is very different, insurance and people paying a huge amount of money. And I think maybe I'm wrong, but the health insurance business is perhaps one of the largest employers in the country. Mm-hmm. So we have a very different system, not dissimilar to others in Europe, but it's funded by the state. The state funds it, the National Health Service, and everybody has access to it. And although you can pay for private medicine, you know, in many cases, the best treatment you're going to get is still on the National Health Service.
And it's not seen as a political issue.
Well, it is seen as a political issue in that the Labour Party are very proud of the fact there was a Labour government after the war, despite all the problems of rebuilding the country after World War II, still managed to set up the National Health Service. But it's been supported by governments of left and right ever since. And there is a bit of a contest in any election of who's going to spend more and who's going to put more money into the National Health Service, because it is medicine and medical technology is moving on all the time. There are advances in medicine, so it does cost money. It does cost more all the time. And government has to recognize that. And when there's a shortage of money, when, you know, we had a period of some years of austerity, it's not been easy. And sometimes the hospitals and doctors and nurses have felt they've been pay restraints and restrictions on how much they can spend. So it has been controversial. It has been difficult.
I want to ask you a bit more about your time in the European Parliament. You were there starting in 1994.
Yes.
Just barely a year after the EU was formed. And when we think back, I wonder when we look at the challenges that Europe, the EU is facing, we're thinking about European sort of transnational institutions, whether that's NATO or the EU, the challenges that are being faced right now. I wonder, what was it like back in 1994? Do you think there was a lot of hope and optimism around the European Union?
Well, you say the European Union was formed then, it was, but the forerunners of it have been going since the 1950s. We'd had common market and European economic community. So it's been gradually moving towards that. When I joined the European Parliament, there were actually only 12 countries, and then it very quickly became 15, and now it's up to 28 countries at the moment. And there's a big difference. It started out as only 6 countries after the war, and it's now 28. So it's encompassing a whole range of countries, Central and Eastern Europe, countries that were formerly in the Soviet Union are now in the European Union. So the whole balance has shifted. And it's been very, very successful in many ways, but a bit like the National Health Service, it's however much it does, it's always going to be criticised for what it hasn't done and the issues that haven't been addressed. So, yes, people are looking at it again and people are seeing if it's really answering all of the questions. But when people actually stop to look at it, the alternatives are very difficult, very different. And that's really what's happening in Britain now. We're suddenly realising the alternatives are something that's not too good.
But that alternative seems to be inevitable at this point, right? I mean, I wonder what your thoughts are on this. I saw you tweeted a poll recently that said that 54% of UK voters would vote to stay in the EU, would remain now if the referendum were held today. But as it stands, I believe, is it March 29th, the date of the official Brexit that's on track? I mean, is there any, do you think there's any sense that that would change?
Well, we're in a situation really in British politics where we don't know what is going to happen because Theresa May's government, the Prime Minister, is negotiating something with the European Union. They're going to come back presumably with a deal which they're going to put to the House of Commons, to Parliament. And at the moment, all the suggestion is that whatever they put to the House of Commons, there isn't a majority for it. So there will be the bizarre, almost unprecedented situation where the government have proposals and nothing can get through. There may be two or three options that would get voted down in the House of Commons, possibly before Christmas, possibly in the new year. And then we could well be in almost a constitutional crisis that we don't know what would happen. Historically, the way out of this would be the government to call a general election. They've said they're not going to do that. The other alternative, which people are pressing for, is a people's vote or another referendum and saying, here's the deal we've negotiated. Is this what you want? Or would you rather stay in the European Union? Prime Minister said she's not going to do that either. So we could be in a sort of situation of impasse where we just don't know what's going to happen.
I wonder if, when you think about from an economic standpoint, certainly there are lots of people, when we look at the UK, British companies or British-owned companies are actually the largest foreign employer in Illinois. There's a lot of ties between the British economy and Illinois' economy. And I think a lot of people are concerned about it, not just from a political, but obviously an economic standpoint. It sounds like, though, you really feel like there's not really anything certain at this point going
forward.
There isn't.
There's a lot of uncertainty. And business community is very worried and apprehensive about what's going to happen. Because at the moment, Britain, a country of 62, 63 million people, is part of the European Union, part of a bloc of 500 million, so bigger than the United States. Now, what's the United States going to, who are they going to want to trade with if Britain leaves the European Union? Are they going to want to trade and have just links with a country of one country, one island of 60 million? Or are they going to deal with the other 500 million? And it looks to me as though Britain will be isolated on the fringes and America will want to continue with the trade links with the whole of the EU. And Britain will be perhaps on the side, putting a hand up saying, please, please, can we be included as well? But we will see.
Robert Evans is a former member of European Parliament. Mr. Evans, thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for today. By the way, speaking of Brexit and British politics, stay tuned to this NPR station. Here now is that Jeremy Hobson is in Europe all this week, bringing you coverage of what's next for the United Kingdom's plans to leave the European Union. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vashisht Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.